Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. This is your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today I'm going to be talking to Simon Shepherd, a very special guest and someone who's well-versed and experienced in three, well, seemingly different but truly related sectors, as we shall be hearing: the sporting world, the corporate world, and what ties them all together, health. By profession, Simon's a chartered physiotherapist, and as you'll hear, he's an engaging and accomplished speaker who certainly captured my attention when I first heard him talk. He's lectured on health and performance-related subjects to a range of audiences all around the world. He's been active at Lord's Cricket Ground. I don't know whether he's actually been on the pitch, but he's been involved for the past 25 years, where he now holds the position of Head of Health and Performance. And in 2008, Simon co-founded Optima Life, a company that specializes in combining technology and training to help organizations and individuals become more purposeful and productive in their respective missions and meet their key performance indicators. Over the course of all these ventures, he's worked with clients, as I say, all across the world, from world-class athletes to leading blue-chip companies. And now I have the pleasure of speaking with him. So welcome, Simon.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I'm looking forward to this.
Absolutely. So let's start at the very beginning. I wanted to begin by talking about your experience as a physiotherapist. Tell us a bit about your practice and experiences, and how do you manage your patient's expectations? You know, the patient's hoping to make a full recovery back to version 1.1 of themselves, 1.0 of themselves, I should say, before whatever took them down. And you're unable, of course, to guarantee an outcome. How do you deal with that? How does your approach vary?
Thank you, Jonathan. First part of the question, experience as a physiotherapist. So I qualified back in 1988, way back in the dark ages. So it's been quite an interesting journey over the last sort of 30 years or so to see how the profession has developed. Because when I first qualified, we were still not long after physiotherapy just been a prescriptive profession with doctors saying, please do this for our patient.
Simon, I just used to write. I had no idea what physios did back then. And I'm afraid I predate you, but I just used to write, please see, advise, and treat, because I had no idea what physios did. I knew they made my patients better, though.
Well, I quite enjoyed those sorts of referrals because it allowed me to think what to do. It was the referrals that came through with a prescription saying we would like the person to do three lots of 30 quadriceps extension exercises twice a day. And, well, I could have just given the person a bit of paper without thinking on the back of that. So things have changed an awful lot. The second part of your question about people's expectations, it's tricky, isn't it? In particular in the world of sport, people need their bodies to be functioning well to deliver the goods. And if they don't deliver the goods, then they don't get the contracts. If they don't get the contracts, then things certainly over the last 20 years or so in the sport that I've worked in, cricket, have become a much higher staked business. So there is pressure working with people. It is a challenge, but I always find honesty and showing an attitude that we're really there to help and do whatever we can, as long as it's safe, tends to go down pretty well with the patients.
Well, you know, there's like any medical therapy, belief is important, right? And as you say, honesty, managing expectations. But there's a mental element to healing, right? If you believe you're going to get better, you're going to get better. And it's something we're going to come on to. In fact, I'll tell you what, let's come at it from the sport perspective. So I'm clearly a masochist. I do like my cricket. But for football, I support Tottenham Hotspur, so I'm definitely a masochist. I've heard it said that the most important part of a footballer's anatomy is their brain. Yes, you know, physical resilience is an obvious advantage in sports, but so is mental strength. From your experiences as a physio, how do mentality and physicality play an equal role in being successful at what you do?
And it's a really interesting question. You can argue it both ways, really. Without the physical attributes, then it's going to be hard to run 100 meters in under 10 seconds, but without the mental adaptability, I really do like this word adaptability, probably more than mental strength, just the mental toolkit that one can have as an athlete and as a performer. For me, that's the difference between good and great.
So adaptability, can you sort of expand on that and tell us what you mean by adaptability?
I think sometimes one has to be cool as a cucumber. There are other times when one might have to ignite an inner rage. There are times when one has to be potentially tough on oneself. There's times when one has to be more loving and caring to oneself. It's having this ability to step back, understand where you are, understand where your opponent is, and then use your mental skill sets in the battle. That's really what sport is.
We don't get, just from my perspective, having, I trained as a physician, and I also trained, was a surgeon specifically, and also as an aviator. And I don't remember anyone ever talking to me about that. Of course, it's right, but why don't we teach people that? Or maybe they do in, top-level sports, but certainly not in other spheres of life. Surely it's important, right?
I agree. If I'm working with a patient, just someone who might come in and see me with a bad back, one of the first things I really want to do is build up a rapport. And to do that, I need to understand their communication style. It isn't just about me telling them what I think. I need to understand how they want to hear it, because that's going to allow me to be way more effective for them. And you know what? Half an hour later, someone might come in with the same problem, but one has to flex and be agile because their communication style or their psychological demands are different.
Okay. All right. Well, it's certainly a component of practicing medicine, adapting one's style of speaking to a patient and explaining things. So I guess it makes sense. So tell us about Optima Life. What caused you to start the company, and what's your primary focus, now?
Sure. Well, I set up Optima Life about 14 years ago with a couple of others, and we were intrigued by stress. All of a sudden, stress had overtaken back pain as the biggest cause of absence from the workplace. And as someone who'd made their living with people being off work with bad backs, I thought I'd better have a look into the opposition and see what this stress thing was all about. So paid for a bit of research to be done. And it was just a throwaway line towards the back end of the paper. And it was, just take a look at this technology. And it was a Finnish technology. And I looked at it and it made me inquisitive and went over to Finland. And I was even more inquisitive having been there. But basically, it allowed us to sort of bring together a physiological understanding of people with a psychological understanding of people. So the technology gathers heart rate and heart rate variability data. But when that's collected, we always keep a diary, and then we map the story alongside the physiology. And I just thought, if that does what it says on the tin, I'm going to be able to do my job better, because I'm going to have the objectivity and the personalization that allows me to be more effective. So that's where Optima Life was sort of, was the acorn that founded Optima Life. And I guess it's grown from there, from being a company that just really did technology, to now a company that actually does training plus technology. So technology is an adjunct to the training programs we run, primarily with businesses.
Well, so I like the idea of technology as a tool to achieve a goal rather than an end in and of itself. Many of our listeners will be familiar with heart rate variability. Many will not. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about that? And some of us have got these watches, these electronic watches that speak to our PDAs, our personal digital assistant. How good are they, and what can we learn from heart rate variability?
Well, I'll do the heart rate variability thing first. So just for those who aren't so familiar with it, a very quick physiology lesson. Heart rate variability is almost a product of our autonomic nervous system. Autonomic nervous system has two branches, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic branch. When the sympathetic branch is activated, blood pressure tends to rise. We tend to release a little bit more adrenaline, potentially cortisol if it's over a long period of time. And the heart will start to beat like a metronome. So we can have a heart rate of 60, but it will beat one beat every second with great regularity. The parasympathetic branch, on the other hand, well, that becomes activated when we're starting to recover. We tend to release more of the recovery hormones, such as DHEA. Blood pressure tends to lower. We sweat a bit less. We could still have a heart rate of 60, but the heart would beat quickly for 5 or 10 seconds, slowly for 5 or 10 seconds, quickly for 5 or 10, then slowly. So heart rate variability is the measurement of the subtle changes between heartbeat. It's often called R to R interval. So that's the first part of the question, looking at what is heart rate variability. Well, the implications by measuring it is it allows us to tell a story. So I will look at intra-individual changes within someone's heart rate variability over a 3 to 5 day period. I'm not really looking at spot checks. We're looking at trends, and we're looking at trends within that person, because everyone's plumbing is slightly different. But it allows them to understand, against a timeline and against their commentary, how their body is responding with day-to-day life. And I do find that powerful. And it's the combination of the commentary and the data that provides the power. I think another question you asked was around the devices that we can all use now. Yes. The watches, the rings, various other bits of jewelry that we can place upon our wrists. Now, I think they've improved massively over the last 5 years. If you'd asked me that question 5 years ago, I would have probably raised an eyebrow and said, maybe limited accuracy, but I think things have changed. And I think particularly at rest, things are pretty good now. But I would also say that regardless of whether it's a device that one wears on the wrist or the device that I use, which is one that you use two ECG electrodes and put on your chest, it is purely data, and it's what we do with it that really makes a difference.
Sure. I mean, just for the benefit of those who haven't used it, I have one of those watches, and I've definitely seen a correlation between days when, you know, I am stressed and things are difficult, and days when I'm kind of chill. There's a very pronounced difference in the heart rate variability. So it's a good reminder. So let's change tack a little bit and talk about learning and collaboration across, well, seemingly competing or unrelated sectors like the corporate world and health. It's quite a stretch you've managed. Tell us about that journey and how it evolved.
Well, if I think of my physiotherapy, I started off in the NHS as a practitioner there. I then moved into sport. And then when I first started, there was not much to do in the winter. So I moved into business, and that business was running my own physiotherapy clinic. And I guess the common denominator between those three sectors is people. Every sector has these things, and we need those people functioning at their best. So I guess that's the common denominator between the three. And it intrigues me how one can get the best out of people and learn across sectors in every dimension.
Right. So as a healthcare practitioner, as someone who practiced surgery for a good number of years, I was certainly aware of burnout and depression. It's been recognized for years now, with the pandemic, it's becoming even more of a problem. And I did a podcast about this a short while back. What can healthcare workers do for themselves, and what sort of things would you recommend to support our healthcare colleagues?
Yeah, it is tough. And I've the last 5 or 6 years in particular, I've done an awful lot of work with NHS workforce. And I think I agree, burnout and levels of fatigue certainly seem to be on the up. I'm relieved that the sort of mental health agenda is coming a little bit to the fore. I'm pleased that people have been encouraged to talk more to each other. I hope that maybe sport could teach NHS teams how to function as teams and look after each other, as well as looking after the patients. And I think that the medical staff have got to remember that it's important to be nice to yourself, not just to your patients. Because if that doesn't happen, then without doubt, the carers of today will become the patients of tomorrow.
Yeah, well, we know about depression rates and suicide and such like amongst healthcare workers, and you're absolutely right, taking the time. In fact, when you talked to us as a group, that was one of the things, that was one of the very powerful points you made. Take time to be kind to yourself, which many of us do not do enough of. So, following that through to the office environment, I see a lot of office lingo drawing parallels between business and sport. And, you know, in fact, the group that arranges these podcasts, EMG, they talk about being gold medal winners, and they apply that kind of sporting lingo. Given your experience, are these sensible parallels? And if so, how do you bridge the gap and best learn the lessons from sport and apply them to business?
Yeah, I think it's interesting how some of the lingo does crop up in different environments. And I often hear these phrases like, we need to improve on the one percenters. We've got to get better, improve on the marginal gains. And I have to be honest, when I'm working with businesses, I often turn around and say, should we just work on the foundation stones first? There's no point in working on that extra 1% if you haven't got the first 60 or 70% right when it comes to your human performance. So whilst the language may sound appealing, to be honest with you, the messages are probably slightly different between the two sectors.
Yeah, I do see that it does kind of work, and that especially if people who are interested in sport and they have that kind of competitive edge to them. So, but I guess what you're saying is use it sensibly, right?
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. And again, it will depend on the individual. So again, using sporting language with someone who doesn't like sport can be quite a turnoff, and actually they'll push away from it. Using sport language with that sort of traditional alpha male who wants to be, you know, the world record holder at everything, well, it could be quite appealing.
Yeah, so horses for courses. So you've been an advisor on some amazing TV shows, World's Strongest Man, Superstars, Gladiators. Have you got any sort of standout anecdotes from your time doing these shows?
Blimey. I guess you want to hear about ones that are polite and I can talk about, don't you?
Well, I don't know. Maybe. Well, let's start with one or two of those and see where it goes.
Well, I remember when we were doing the World's Strongest Man over in South Africa, we used some real-time heart monitors on these people who were pulling trucks. Now, they're a certain body shape anyway, so they tend to have maybe a slightly elevated heart rate and slightly elevated blood pressure. But when I saw a young lad's heart rate go up to 214, I thought, wow, not seen this one before. So that was quite an interesting thing as he tried to pull a truck up and down this course.
214?
Yeah.
Good Lord.
That was quite something. So that was interesting. What else could I tell you? Well, Superstars was fascinating because it was, for those of you who don't know, Superstars was a program for the 1970s, but they brought it back in the early 2000s, and it basically pitches sports people from different disciplines against each other. So they might swim and they might run and they might play golf and they might do basketball, all of these things. And I can't remember which version it was, but it was shortly after an Olympic Games, and there are a whole load of Olympians taking part. And I think it was the first time they touched alcohol for about a year. And it was really quite amusing watching these people try to get out of bed the next morning and compete against each other. It was literally a week or two after the Olympics that it was shot. So it's a massive holiday for these people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's stay with sport. So there'll be some folks listening from the USA who may not be familiar with rugby, although it is starting to make an appearance there. And I tell people who don't know that it's like American football, but without the suits of armor and no cheerleaders, or rarely so. When you're not working, I understand that you can be found refereeing rugby matches. What possesses you to assume a position that's been called the least desirable in all of sport?
Well, the first thing I'm going to say, I'm just easing off a little bit on that, but I have thoroughly enjoyed my career as a referee. I do it more than any other reason because I find it one of the most mindful experiences that I go through on a weekly basis. For 80 minutes, work just goes out of my brain. Funnily enough, family life goes out of my brain, and I just focus on the moment because if I don't, I look stupid. And I find it one of the best experiences of my week just to calm down. And it also appeals to me because it's a challenge and I like a challenge.
Hmm. Well, I've been watching football for many years and playing as well. And I find myself always asking that question when the referee's made a decision and the players surround the ref and start, you know, remonstrating. The number of times I've seen a referee say, you know what, you're right, it wasn't a foul, I'm not going to send you off. Of course, we now have video assistant referees, but have you had those kind of experiences? And do you think what you do professionally colours the way you behave as a ref?
I'm fortunate in rugby is that most of the time the players don't surround you. In fact, they have a habit and a tradition of calling you sir. So maybe I also get very excited about this sort of great ego trip one can go go on it, you know, every weekend with lots of big grown thugs calling you sir and being very polite to you. I have probably more problems with the parents if I'm doing sort of a high level schools game. The players are absolutely fine. It's the parents who are the biggest nightmare.
I just have to share with you that when my son was playing soccer, as they call it in the States, I lived there for many years and I did some coaching. And the number of times I had to go and speak to parents and tell them, I'm sorry, you can't use language like that. And, you know, you can't shout at children. And one dad said to me, well, that's my son. And yeah. I thought, oh, you poor kid living with him.
And rugby is actually very fortunate. We can send people out of the ground. So, again, when you brief the coaches of the children's teams before a match, I'm really clear. I say, you've got two jobs to do, my friend. One is be a fantastic coach and the other is be a fantastic policeman. Because any of these people up and down the touchline misbehave, you know what we're going to be doing.
Yeah, good for you. Good for you. And of course, people in America carry guns. So I always had that in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier, elite athletes having an issue getting out of bed. Sleep's critical to good functioning and good health. And each year, it seems we learn more and more about how important sleep is for our health. Tell our listeners a wee bit about your work with sleep analysis and so on.
Okay, again, using the heart rate variability, we can start to really understand the quality of sleep. So sleep is measured in a number of ways. It could be measured with EEG. It can be measured with movements, actigraphy. I prefer using heart rate variability because it's probably a functional and a fairly accurate way of doing it. But it's our most deliberate coping mechanism. It's something we do for 30% of our lives or so. But until recently is something that we paid very little attention to. And I think whether I'm talking to a business person or an athlete or a patient, I'm now including it as part of my strategy to help them either become better because they're in pain or better because they want to be a sports person or better because they want to execute more sales or hit more targets, etc. For me, it's a critical foundation stone, not just of one's health, but also of one's performance.
And what sort of situations do you discover? So you discover someone's got impaired sleep using heart rate variability. Do you then get involved in solutions? Do you refer them to a sleep specialist? What's your modus operandi?
Sure. So it will partly depend on what we pick up. I mean, if we pick up someone and it looks like there's potential sleep apnea there are also other symptoms relating to sleep apnea, then that means an onward referral. But it's incredible how some of our lifestyle habits will impact our sleep. So the basic ones would be things like alcohol, for example. And I drink. It's not saying don't drink. But alcohol, typically for every unit of alcohol, people will lose about an hour's worth quality sleep. If you eat late, that's going to impact your sleep. If you're on your mobile phone or a device that's emitting a fair degree of blue light, that's going to stimulate your pineal gland, which will increase the amount of dopamine floating around your body. Again, not the greatest thing to do just before you sleep. Environmental factors. In sport, we try and pay a lot of attention. If people are moving from hotel to hotel to hotel, have you checked your pillow, the light sources, the noise sources, and the temperature of the room? And the last thing I spend quite a lot of time working on with people is switching your mind off. It's not just about switching your body off. So how good are you at switching your mind off?
So do you use like mindfulness tools to achieve that?
Yeah, we can use mindfulness tools. There are all sorts of techniques. So my favorite technique, to be fair, is actually I have a blank book. So when I'm going through a really busy period of my life, I get the blank book out, and about 45 minutes before I go to bed, I draw a line down the middle of the page. And on the left-hand side of the line, I write down what I've done today. Normally makes me feel a bit better about life. And on the right-hand side, I write down what needs to be done tomorrow. And I look at it, and I slowly close the book, 5 deep breaths. It's a bit of a ritual. And I'm just giving myself permission to switch my brain off. I don't have to keep remembering all these things overnight. They're written down.
Hmm. Interesting. I have a similar discipline of moving things from things I wanted to achieve and didn't, and move them to the next day. But it's very, very satisfying deleting items you've done.
Yeah.
Isn't it? There's that.
That is.
Yeah, you're right. You're like, again, I guess it's being kind to yourself. So if we think about performance and the banded about term KPIs, key performance indicators, how does one best, I guess, identify, design, choose which ones you're going to deploy for yourself, for your organization, and deploy them? How does one do that?
Tricks? Okay, well, the first thing I'd say is we put an H in there, so we'll make it HPIs, key human performance indicators, because I think that is a useful phrase to describe these catalysts that can help people achieve the KPIs. In terms of the ingredients, and I use a number of ingredients which will range from working on people's mindset, their environment, and that's not just the physical environment, but also the cultural environments that one's in. Yes, we will work on sleep, nutrition, exercise, time management, organization, creating focus. That would be another category. Exercise, important. I think I've said that. And then the last one is making sure that you have a healthy relationship with yourself and you're responsible to you. And those are sort of the levers that I'll work with, and between myself and a client, formulate the best recipe for them.
I like that last one very much, because if you're not in a good place with yourself, everything else goes to hell in a handbasket, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Really thought about it like that. So as we near the end of our allotted time, I like to ask all my guests some version of this question. Given all you know, all you've learned, all you've achieved, what one or two things would you recommend everyone deploy to be healthier, and I mean that in the fullest sense of the word, and more productive?
It's a good question. I think I'm going to pick up on the theme that we just visited, which is actually how can you create an emotional attachment between your behaviors and what's good for you? But of course, we need to understand what's good for us. And therefore, we've got to really have the odd moment when we think, where am I? How am I feeling? Does this feel right? How do I want to feel in the future? And then put the action against it. Because of course, everyone wants to be healthy. And it, for me, why do you want, when people say, I want to be healthy, I just turn around to them and go, well, why? It's important for people to answer that question, why, and then create the emotional attachment and a greater understanding of themselves.
It's interesting because people, I would imagine, would normally give a glib answer to that. You know, I go to the gym. Well, why do you go to the gym? That's really interesting. It's, okay. Well, it's a good one. And I guess a good one to end on. Thanks so much for joining us, Simon. And as you and I discussed, I'm looking forward to getting together to learn more. We appreciate all you're doing.
Pleasure. And thank you very much for having me. And as a Tottenham Hotspur fan, I think we better put a heart rate monitor on you while you're watching them, Jonathan.
I know. It's the expression Spursy has even entered the lexicon of someone who snatches defeat from the jaws of victory.
Wow.
But anyway, given there are so many more subjects we could talk about, so we're going to have you back on again very soon. And thanks for joining me today, everyone. It's been enlightening, to say the least. Tune in again next Friday on the EMG Health Podcast to continue hearing from more amazing leaders and change makers. Until then, stay safe. And as Simon says, be nice to yourself. Bye for now.